I'm Doug Fern, and this is my take on music recording. Chris Tabron is a Brooklyn-based producer, engineer, and mixer who has worked with artists such as Beyoncé, The Strokes, Robert Glasper, Battles, Lower Dens, The Voids, and Charlotte Day Wilson. We start our conversation by exploring his early influences and how he learned his craft. Were you from a musical family? What was your attitude towards music growing up?
It's interesting. I think I know what you mean when you say a musical family in the traditional sense. In my sense of it, I would say, yes, I was from a very musical family, although nobody played any instruments. I think I came from a musical family in the sense of music was a really big part of road trips. I remember listening to Sam Cooke in the car with my dad driving down to North Carolina to visit family. And I probably was the only four-year-old around who knew all the words to all the Sam Cooke songs. And my mom listening to Santana and Fania All-Stars and stuff in the kitchen around the house. And, you know, I've since pilfered some of their vinyl collection to my own. So in that sense, I would say music was an important part of family life, although none were musicians. My brother actually was a hobbyist and used to DJ and used to produce, and he actually taught me how to use an MPC sequencer and programmer. But I think in the non-traditional sense, I would call my family musical, as we were fans of music in our lives, and kind of the way we entered the world was very influenced by music.
I know you got started as a DJ, but what was your first experience with recording?
I think my first experience with recording was recording myself and figuring, just out of necessity, sort of figuring that out. I think early on, one of two things, my dad had a Grundig, an old German reel-to-reel. Mm-hmm. That one of the kind that came in the suitcase that makes you think you're in a spy movie, that I think was quarter inch in the basement. And I didn't know, I mean, I must have been under 10 years old, but I've always been one of those people that likes to take apart things and see how they work and modify them. And so I was given license to investigate that on my own accord. And it was amazing to me that I didn't know the actual physics of what actually magnetic tape recording did. I just knew that it was weird that I could record my voice into this thing or into a micro cassette, you know, dictaphone that my dad had and hear myself back and think about, wow, that sounds like me, but it also sounds a little bit higher pitched. Why is that? Or if I kind of run my thumb along the wheel while it's playing, it kind of slows down a little bit. That was fascinating to me. And I think also a lot of early recording was spent doing what was we would call, you know, pause tapes or mixtapes, where you have your cassette recorder tuned to a radio station on record pause mode and you wait for the DJ to stop talking over the intro or your song. And as soon as he stops talking on the downbeat, you hit unpause and you make a mixtape for your friends or a girl you like or whatever. And I think I did a lot of that. And whenever I'd make mixtapes for people, I would say the production value of my mixtapes in junior high school were probably head and shoulders above maybe what the other seventh graders were doing, because I'd figured out ways to layer things. And, you know, so I think that's probably the first amateur recording sense. And then I had, you know, when I started making demos to make a record, I had a Porta Studio 424 Tascam. And that I could fly, and I still have it. I'm staring at it right now in my studio. I could fly on that thing. It was amazing the way you could jump tracks. And I think, you know, maybe taking your question a step further, the first moment where I realized the kind of tangibility of recording was when I had to jump tracks down. You know, you bounce them down, you know, tracks 3 and 4 to track 1 to have room to do more layers. And it starts to sound a little gushier and a little weirder. And the hi-hat is a little darker now. And because, you know, I'm using old tapes that probably aren't even the right bias for the machine because I was broke. And now I'm just, it sort of clicked, like, wow, the actual medium is a part, it's playing a part in the actual music. That was the first bell that I remember going off when I was making early, just guitar vocal demos, that, wow, like the actual apparatus that we're using to record is affecting it. It's not just a kind of clinical, dry, sterile presentation, but you're playing with it.
You were doing your own music?
Yeah, so I started out, as a lot of people do, you sort of get your feet wet repurposing other people's music, or some people play covers, you know, when they're learning to play guitar, or some people, in my case, I would do remixes of things, or extended edits for, and my first real experiences in quote-unquote production were making extended edits for DJing, you know, so I would load something into a sequencer, usually by this point, Pro Tools, or at that point, whatever the free version of Pro Tools was, I think you were allowed 4 tracks free. And that was my first experience in actually nonlinear editing. It was about, how do I make this intro last really long so that I can kind of do a remix thing live in the club for DJing. So that was how I started out. And then, yeah, I started making my own music and kind of compiling a bunch of demos when I lived in Brooklyn in an apartment that was illegal enough that I could make enough noise in. I'd play drums and I had a synthesizer. I think at some point I had a CS80, which I'm embarrassed to say I sold for a song.
So many things we get rid of that we regret.
Oh man. Oh man. And yeah, and Juno and all that. Yeah, all those things. And yeah, it was just basically me in a loft with probably, I think the nicest mic I had might have been a 414.
Mm-hmm.
Not even an EB, just a BULS 414. And I was just using the preamps on the tape deck on the Porta Studio. And yeah, I was just making, and it was sort of, in a lot of ways, the Wild West, in terms of, we're talking early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah, the internet was a thing, and you could sort of research what you wanted to look up, but it wasn't nearly like it is now, where you can pretty much find 3 YouTube videos on how to mic up a drum kit within 4 seconds. So my research and my kind of training was, I would listen to drums on a record that I liked, and then I would look at my drum kit and my limited knowledge in recording, my limited ability to play, my limited mic locker, and try and recreate that somehow. So there were a lot of SM57 as overheads. There was a lot of experimenting, I'll say. But yeah, that was kind of me having a sense of, all right, well, I have this lull in my DJing schedule, and I'd like to try and make a record and write songs from scratch. So it was sort of the fade between those two worlds of like repurposing other people's music and sampling and making extended edits, and then kind of making my own and writing my own songs.
How would you characterize the genre of your original stuff back then?
That's a good question. I would say it probably was solidly mediocre electronic pop. Don't everyone rush to the record store at once. Yeah, I was 20, 21, and I think I was making a lot of music that was probably pretty derivative of my influences of the time at the time. And I'm not being just self-deprecating. I think that it's just pretty an honest assessment. But in a lot of ways, that served me to learn to be a producer, because once the record came out, it was done and dusted. Like I think within a few months, like the first TV on the Radio EP came out, and it was amazing. And everything that I was hoping to do sonically, musically, at a songwriting level, but way more effortless, way more natural. And I remember feeling this kind of relief and looking at the work of people like Dave Siddick, who was the producer of that record and that band, and his contemporaries and being and kind of having this second kind of light bulb moment of like, oh, if I want to make music, I can help other people make records. That's actually a job. I don't have to be an artist. Because I didn't really, the being an artist and the going on tour thing didn't really sit with me as something I wanted to do long term. It seemed like a means to an end, and I didn't really, I was like, oh, if you have songs and you have ideas, you have to be an artist and you have to be in a band and you have to do this, because those were who all my friends were at the time. I didn't know any other producers or engineers. I just knew bands. And then that record was really seminal for me in a way, because I was like, oh my God, I can help other people make records. This is, I think some people might have taken that as a blow, that like their record wasn't a commercial success. But for me, it was a relief in a way. And as I've said before, I kind of embarked on the journey of being a producer because it is simultaneously the hardest thing I've ever done and also the most natural thing.
You're in Brooklyn now, but is that where you grew up?
I grew up in Long Island. Mm-hmm. About an hour and a half away from the city. And then I moved when I went to school at NYU. So I, 99, I think I graduated high school. Yeah. So I moved probably the summer before that. But I'd always kind of been back and forth to the city. The city wasn't like, Long Islanders call New York the city, mm-hmm. but it wasn't this mystery to me. I had been here quite a bit and spent a lot of time underage in clubs I probably shouldn't have been in. Although I'd say, and the choice to go to NYU was more about, I just want to live in the city. And it's great that they're going to give me a decent scholarship and I'll make a decent time of it in the city, but I'm living in the city and taking classes. I didn't want a campus life. I want to be able to go to Smalls. You know, back in the day, Smalls was this jazz club off of 7th Avenue that didn't even have a liquor license. It was BYOB. And sometimes the door guy who knew that I was well under 21 would let me in if I would stand at the door while he went around the corner and smoked a cigarette or smoked something else and took people's fees for, you know, an hour or so. And then he'd let me sit in the back and you'd see, you know, the people that were in the audience was almost as exciting as the people on stage, because there'd be like Joshua Redman in the audience and he'd be called on stage like, hey man, did you bring your axe? Anyone could jump on at any given point. Yeah. It's a long way to answer where I'm from, but I think that I kind of more readily identify culturally, I'd say I'm from the city because that's where I've been.
Tell us about your early experiences recording bands and getting into producing.
Yeah. I was the first band that I recorded because I had played everything. After that, the people that heard my record were really just kind of other bands, which was a blessing. And I remember quite a few were like, hey, would you help us produce our record? And I had no idea what even that entailed. To be honest, producing a record to me meant locking yourself in a loft for a year and singing the same vocal take over and over because you refused to use autotune, you know? So I was just like, yeah, I mean, I'm 21 at this time, something like that. I didn't know very much. And I had some friends that were in bands that were at the same level and they were down to explore and make mistakes together and have fun with it. You know, it wasn't a really high pressure situation except for me putting pressure on myself to want to grow and push towards kind of whatever I had conceived was excellence at the time. So a lot of it was me working at rehearsal spaces, recording bands and getting them better recordings than they could at their rehearsal spaces on their own. And then that would, you know, we'd rent out a studio or we'd go to a different spot, you know, upstate at a friend's house and or turn a house into a studio. And I'd take, you know, basically because I was young and I was living cheaply and eating rice and beans, any amount of money that a band would pay me, I would just reinvest in gear. So it was like, oh, now I'm going to buy an 1176 and eat more rice and beans. or now I'm going to buy a brass capsule 414 or so on and so forth. You know, it's sort of just like the regurgitation of just moving money from one group of people who have more money than me to another group of people who have more money than me. But I was lucky enough to, I mean, this is, you know, early 2000s, mid-2000s New York. there was a scene, I mean, there were a lot of bands around. There were a lot of, like Sidek Studio, Stay Gold. I would, like, kind of hang around there every now and then. I don't know, even know if he would even remember me at this point hanging around there. But, like, I remember rewiring, circuit bending Speak and Spells because I knew how to solder really well. And I would just kind of, like, that would be my rent I would pay to just, like, train spot these guys. Or, like, you know, the Chris Codys of the world and those guys that were always around in that scene before all these guys had this mass exodus to L.A. They were in New York. They were in Williamsburg. And between going to shows and hanging out at studios, like, I was working with a band 6, sometimes 7 days a week. And after a while, I worked with another mixer producer named Alex Newport. He had a studio called Future Shock in Greenpoint and in this building called the Pencil Factory. And that was a great studio. He had an AMEC Einstein with super true automation. I'll never forget that, VCA-based automation. Mm. And we sort of pulled some of our gear together. And I'd say a lot of our sessions were tape. We did an MTR. We had an Atari MX-80. Yeah, it's MTR-90 and MX-80, the one that doesn't auto-align. Good-sounding tape deck or tape machine. And I think I really, between around that same time, maybe a little bit before that. I think probably a little bit before that. I'm getting my chronology a little bit mixed up. But I think around, 2003-ish, I met Tony Maserati. And I got to work with him at either Chungking or Sony or upstate at his house, at his farm upstate. And so I had kind of by some luck and or hard work, I had this top flight mixing engineer who would let me look over his shoulder and help him out and was working in these amazing studios. I had my home studio, which was probably a pair of NS10s in my living room and a Digi 002 at the time, and a pretty good indie studio that had a full analog console and tape machine and a decent live room. So I could converge around all these really disparate ways of making music and kind of pick from each of them and develop my own sound that way. So there was a flow for maybe 4 or 5 years in the middle there where I was just, if a band had a few $100, like, let's do it. I don't care, you know, because my rent was so cheap again and the rice and bean diet will get you far. And I was just learning, you know, I was just like, that was my, in a lot of ways, that was sort of like me earning my master's, you know, in recording. And I knew that I didn't want to be a recordist forever, but I think that being a recordist can help you be conversant in mixing and in production in a lot of ways, and not just in technical ways, in interpersonal ways. I think having to be in the room with a lot of different personalities and having to keep a cadence of a session going and moving forward and not getting stuck on things, but also being patient and waiting for the right moment for the right take to emerge and knowing when it's the right take or knowing when you have the comp or knowing, you know, all those things, or even just having 7 different ways to get drums to sound dirty if the producer is asking you to make things sound dirty. You know, like working with Alex, who was a good engineer in his own right and hadn't really had a proper assistant or engineer at the time, was great because he would tell me to set something up and give me a couple of references and I'd have to just do it by the time he came back from going in to get a sandwich. So I really was using that time to kind of develop my tool set sonically and to be able to kind of communicate that way. So the transition to being a producer, you know, I think a lot of those sessions that I was producing, you know, to an indie band that really doesn't know what they're doing and an engineer that doesn't really know what they're doing, they're both kind of producing in a lot of ways. It's inadvertent that you're both sort of producing, and I think that's a good thing. I think that it leads to experimentation. It leads to a really fun and disarming approach to making music. So, you know, I probably wasn't credited as producer on those things, but I think I've always had a producer's mindset because I never went to audio school. You know, I never had any formal training in any of these things. I kind of just had, maybe in some ways you could just say an aptitude for these things and electronics and signal flow and maybe physics or whatever, but also just being a nerd and hating not knowing how to do things. Mm-hmm. And just voraciously wanting to learn. And also having my back against the wall with like somebody like Tony, who's, you know, pushing me to like do something on an SSL, and I'm sitting there at Chungking and I'm in the room with him, but yet all these graduates of audio school are sitting staring at the same phone in the lobby, and I've got like a bullseye on my back because they want to be in the room, and they're like, how'd this guy get in the room? He didn't even go to school. So I'm reading manuals and bribing interns to like let me go to Kinko's and make Xeroxes of the manuals that aren't supposed to leave the premises so that I know how to use the G plus automation, you know. All of these things kind of, I think it's, you know, a producer is kind of a mindset when I think about it, because production, I've said this many times, a producer is just somebody who takes an idea and makes it real. So I think all a producer's mindset really is to look at something for what it can be, not just what it is. I think that I couldn't tell you when I became a producer. They don't, as you probably know, give you a badge or a desk. So I think it just sort of naturally became something I developed as I became, as I said, more conversant and more able to help musicians get the best of themselves, or help a sound kind of become, or a song kind of become its best version of itself. I think that one thing that bears underlining or emphasizing in the producer relationship is that you are routinely expecting people to put themselves in a vulnerable position. And you are routinely challenging them and coddling and validating and you know, all things along the spectrum. And usually a producer, if the producer is not inside the band and someone that you went to high school with, you know, usually the producer is this person that is the first quote-unquote outsider, the first person that's not a proven loyal friend that you have to kind of give the trust to. And you it takes a lot of vulnerability to have this thing that's so important to you, that is your music, that you've worked on maybe with a group of high school friends or people that you've known forever, and you can only get it but so far, and now it comes time to, well, we need help with this. Can you help us with this? That's a pretty vulnerable position to be in for a lot of artists, to ask for the help of an outside producer. So I think it is a psychiatrist's role. I think that it is sort of somebody who keeps things flowing and anticipates and can see the potential in things and can sort of keep his or her eye on the horizon. But I think it's also somebody who needs to get down in the trenches and meet the artist more than halfway with the vulnerability. I think that there's a really, you know, I at least for me, try to have as humanistic an approach to production as possible. And I think that sometimes I've produced records that I've had to play a bunch of instruments on. Sometimes I've had to produce records and I literally need to just say, can you just use this type of pick instead of the heavier pick? And let's go. Or sometimes production means, and you know this, Doug, that sometimes production means, no, this song's great, you guys are done.
Right.
You know, it's sometimes, and then you take those because that probably means you're going to have a few days where it means you have to play every instrument. But, you know, I think it's a lot of it is just setting the tone and putting people in a place where they can do what they are meant to do best. And that's meant sometimes me getting to the studio really early and making sure the band's guitars are intonated, because it only takes about 10 minutes of guitar. Let's just do it. Or sometimes that means pushing, you know, and getting them a little pissed off at you, and you kind of become the blast shield for that anger, and you get that sentiment that you needed, because it's an angry song, into the mic. You know, I think that the optimal situation usually for a producer is you get an artist to do something that they're probably never, ever going to do again in a performance, and we just happen to be recording it, and now everyone can enjoy it forever. You know, and we all know records that we know, that we listen to repeatedly, that we're very thankful that the producer got that performance.
Do you like getting involved in the earliest incarnation of the song, where you're actually working with the artist on the song structure, tempo, key, and all that?
I do. Pre-production to me is a really important part of making a record. Not only is it the kind of getting to know you part, what I really like about the early part is the potential. You know, it's like it, we haven't. It's like if you think of songs as people, it's like it's a baby. It could be anything. It could be president of the United States or an architect or a modern dancer or a painter or whatever. You know, like usually songs in their early stages, or even if they're just kind of a, you know, an iPhone voice note stage, we'll call it. It can be anything, and very rarely is it a phase where anybody in the process is saying what something cannot be yet. It's too early. You know, like we could make it into a waltz right now, or we can add a bar of five at measure 100 because it feels like, you know, or it can be anything. And I really enjoy the early parts of that when you're figuring things out and you're kind of pushing on things and you're messing with the tempo or you're changing the key or you're throwing it into a sampler and chopping it up, or you're thinking maybe it needs to be this kind of vocal on the song, or maybe we need to have a dulcimer on the song. Or I really like that phase because of the potential, and also I find it incredibly exciting that the song kind of can reveal itself to you. I really like that moment where you're doing the excavation. It's pretty irrefutable in the room when you've nailed it. Oh, this is gonna be there it is. I love that. And it's just like, it's almost like surfing, right? You know, you have to have like 15 waves go by you, and then you get a one wave that you ride for 7 seconds, and it just gets you addicted and you just want more. So I think I like the excavating. I like the sort of, to extend the metaphor, the paddling out phase, you know, the like watching some waves go by, missing a few. Like I like letting it, yeah, I guess the best way to put it is letting it reveal itself to us. And I think it also just, pre-production is a really quick and effective and fairly painless, usually, knock on wood, way to get everybody working as a team facing the same direction to a common goal. And I think that that's when a lot of great things happen with music, because nobody's really married to any ideas yet. No one can be overly precious because we don't know what this is. Once the song is written and we know the key and we know the tempo, and now you're just trying to execute this part in these overdubs, well, now we're a little bit too attached to it. You know, we're more attached to it already. When we don't know what it is yet and we're exploring to find it, to find the right suit of clothes for this person, the trying on phase can be really exciting because it can be anything. And I think that that sort of taps into kind of my early encounters with music, you know, the rubbing my thumb against the capstan of the tape machine and getting the pitch to change, or the kind of tangibility of excavating and diving into something that you don't really know what you're going to find yet, but there's these other people that are equally excited to be on this journey with you.
Yeah, I've often said the music tells you what it wants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also think it is also the purest way to say that it's about the service of the song.
Right.
It's not about ego. It's not about sales. It's not about the band or the manager or the label. And they'll all get involved, believe me. And those phone calls will happen. But the service of the song is probably the most ideal way to embark on this pursuit, you know. And that's also a great way to recenter and to that's why I'm always recording. I always keep keep a live two-track going. Now I just keep a voice note going because it's easier, of us exploring those early demos, because there's something there that's exciting. And I've played them from my phone on speaker during the mixing phase to make sure that we're keeping whatever was exciting 3 months ago so that the listener can hear it. You know, like it's a great way of putting it. I think that, it, you know, in the service of the song, has what the way that I've been trying to guide what I've been doing in kind of my entire adult life, really.
Well, every time you say something, it sends me off in a new direction of things I want to ask.
Well, you know, I have a question for you, actually. I don't know if this is untoward of me, if I'm allowed to ask you questions, but I have
a
question.
Yeah, sure.
You've done stuff in radio, right?
I started out in radio, yeah. I mean, yeah. As an engineer. That was mm-hmm. back in the days when, at least in the major markets, and this was in Philadelphia, where the engineer really produced the radio show and the announcer talked when you turned on his mic.
Yeah.
You know, so exactly. it's totally different today.
Yeah.
But I spent so many hours on late night talk shows. There was a very interesting station I worked for because they had the whole first floor of the building was one big studio. And it was actually where the predecessor to American Bandstand came from. Mm. And they had converted into this audience talk show at night.
Is this in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And they had like just the most amazing people come through there. I mean, it was like the top names in any field you could imagine. And that was really helpful to me, especially since a lot of times the hosts of these shows would, they would actually, if they had an author on who they didn't, or music, and they weren't really interested in learning about it, they'd give me the book or the record and say, come up with some questions for me. I don't know what to do with this. and just listening to good interviewers and bad interviewers, I think, helped me to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And I'm not good at it. I'm not a good interviewer, but I like to mostly just ask a few questions and let people talk as long as they want, because they always have interesting things to say. I mean, no matter who you talk to, they're interesting people somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm not sure why you were asking about the radio part.
It's funny because I think of, when I think about how I started out, I often leave this out, and I don't know why. I think it's just probably a confluence of forgetting and maybe not really fully connecting the dots until I'm asked. But I spent a lot of time doing college radio at NYU, and that had a huge influence on me as a producer, because I was able to, I would spend, and this shows you how little partying I did in college. I would spend weekend nights in the radio room in the library amongst 20,000 records and God knows how many CDs that were just there for me to listen to and or copy onto my laptop back when there were CD drives and laptops at will and just learn. And I would just like, I would spend an entire weekend just in the M's of band, you know, and there's just all this music and it's all outside, because it was, you know, it was free form, but usually kind of outside of the realm of popular music. So this is all underground, independent stuff, emerging artists. That, I think, also really influenced me in how I approach new music, how I approach new sounds and the pre-production phase with artists, also the type of artist that I like and what I want to work on in a more involved capacity. But I think the reason I ask you about radio is because there's also this, in the sense of the service of the song, what we were talking about before, there's this kind of community about radio that isn't there really with streaming, or if you go and put on a record at home, there's this implied community of, well, at any given point, maybe 500,000 people are listening to the same song right now that this guy selected or this woman selected for this moment. And I really love that. I mean, that's what I loved about DJing and kind of anticipating the moods and being able to manage energy in a room, which really is kind of all mixing is. But radio was really exciting to me, A, doing live things and interviewing people on the radio, but also just like the excitement of knowing how many people could be listening and that this song is kind of a through line between all these people and their lives at this given moment right now. Maybe it's an idealistic way of looking at radio, but I'm not sure if you've ever thought about that in terms of how you approach music and the type of music that you like, or even just thinking about what a song, I guess, what the power of what a song can do, just broadly construed.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, radio is kind of a strange thing because it's not like DJing in the room where you have an audience and you get feedback. You understand what they're looking for and how can you satisfy their needs. In radio, a lot of times, it's like we're doing right now. You know, we're doing radio, essentially. We're just sitting here talking to each other, but there's no audience. I mean, they're out there. They will be out there, but we don't see them now. And one of the things that I learned from working with lots of good on-air people was you picture one listener, you know, like your ideal fan, and you talk to them. And gives radio that sort of one-on-one intimacy that is different than when you're talking to a room full of people. And I think that's one of the, or it used to be anyway, the appeals of radio was that a listener could be out there and truly feel that the announcer, the DJ, whatever you want to call him, was talking just to them. It's kind of something.
That's great. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And we've kind of lost that. And it's the same thing, you know, when you say when you have, you know, who knows how many people listening to the same song at the same time. It's the same thing with TV, because back in the days when there were three networks and, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show came on, you knew almost everybody you knew were going to be watching that show that night.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day you could talk about it. I mean, today, what do? You know, you tell somebody about something
just
you watch.
Demand.
Yeah, you watch something on Netflix and they say, oh, that's interesting. I never heard of that movie.
That's the thing. Yeah. I don't. That's great. That just thinking that I'm thinking about one listener and talking to that one. I would do that when I would DJ in a club. I would just single out one person. I'd be like, I'm going to play this person's favorite song. Like, didn't know the song. Don't know them at all. Just like looking at them, watching what they're dancing to, and try to like figure. And that's what I think a great DJ, radio or club, can do, is like put on a song that you wanted to hear before you knew you wanted to hear it.
Right.
And there's something, it's almost spiritual, but there's something really connective about capturing that energy, you know? And that's why the way that I approach mixing, I kind of like, I'll mix for a little bit and then I'll ignore it and I'll walk away. And I try to like not get too familiar and too overly invested in the song. I want to keep that kind of lightning in a bottle feeling, because you only have this chance to hear something once in your life, right? And then once you've heard it once. But I think it's funny having you talk about radio. There are two moments that I can point to that made me really kind of get the chills about music and about, you know, I think music/radio and or community. One of them was the first time I had a radio show, because at NYU we were on FM airwaves in New York City, which was great. It was 89.1, and I'm like, wow, I'm on FM radio in New York City and I'm 20 years old. This is crazy. Was opening up the phone lines and watching the phone lines light up, like people actually calling in that are listening to my show. Like, it was bizarre to me to have that kind of interaction and that feedback, and like, you know, you try and you get some weirdos and you get some people that are calling because they want concert tickets or whatever. But like, I remember the moment, the first time I actually did that, and I'm just like, no one's gonna lean. And then you look and the lights are all just going like Christmas lights. And the second moment that I had was recording. It was like, I think maybe the first, yeah, it must have been the first time I actually recorded on tape on a 2-inch. I remember, and still to this day, I still get this feeling a little bit, but like, you know, you go in the live room and you start scratching mics and whatever, and then you just sort of set everything up, everything's aligned, and then you just, in my case, I would go play the drums like really, really loud just to make sure that my levels would be okay from the band got there. And I come back and I play it back and I'm just like, it all hit me. And I was like, we shouldn't be allowed to do this. this is magic. Like like there's just like iron filings randomized across this piece of plastic. And now we're just organizing them in a certain way. And now I can hear them. Like, that's just crazy. And there's never a moment when mainly it happens with analog sessions, but usually when I'm tracking, I have a little quiver of that same excitement every time, where it's just like, this is magic. We can do this. This is insane. But those two moments, yeah, they're like, I can feel them. You know, the excitement of those two ways that, like, I don't know. I think that it's easy to be sort of, particularly 2020, I think it's easy to be kind of jaded about things, but I like to kind of keep the excitement of what we do at the forefront. Otherwise, you know, I could just get a desk job doing something else.
Well, I agree with you completely on that. And it, you know, for me, I'm fortunate that I don't need to record to make money, so I can just do the projects I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that just makes it so much more fun because I'm just going for, you know, what pleases me and the artist and developing that excitement without having any other outside influence to answer to, you know. It's a luxury that I really appreciate. I mean, I can't imagine I'll ever make any money doing that, but it really pleases me. And I've always said, if I didn't learn something new in every session I did, something's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and I know from listening to some of the records that you've done, you know, some of which I was familiar with before, and I now listen to them again with you in mind, and I said, wow, that is so clever. That is so well done. That's just perfect. But he went so far out on a limb, I don't think I'd have the courage to do that.
I bet you some of those limbs were mistakes, man. You never know. Yeah. Maybe the only difference between a mistake and genius is just the timeline you put it on. But
you kept it, though. You know, you didn't say, oh, yeah, I can't use that.
Fair enough. Oh, I can't tell you how many times I've been working on something, especially tracking. Like, I would say I'm an above average tracking engineer, but by no means a good one or a great one. I do it as a necessity. You know, I love recording vocals. That I'll say I'm good at. But, you know, other things, I love recording drums. Everything else is sort of like, okay, I can do it, but I'd rather hire a recordist, particularly if I'm producing. Mm-hmm. But so I can't tell you how many times I'll just stumble onto something and I'll have set something up and you know, then I'll just like look over at the, and it'll be sounding great, and I'll look over at the meters or I'll look over at the EQ and be like, huh, it sure is a lot, but okay, we're going to go with it. You know, that's what I also love about a console, you know, not to romanticize a console, but I love tracking with a console because A, I can make sure that I've got really great monitoring for the artists and I got good cues and mixes and submixes for them, but it's imprecise. You know, I don't know how much, I know that full swing on an SSL is 15 dB, but I don't know exactly if I'm at 2.4K or at 3.1, you know, like it's just sort of, you know, turn it until it feels good. And I like that there's an imprecision there because it feels like you're more like you're playing an instrument. But yeah, so many times, and I learned also just that a lot of people that I looked up to in mixes and productions that I've studied over the years, I've been fortunate enough to ask a lot of these people, hey, what were you doing? Like, how'd you get that? Or, oh, I don't even remember. Or, yeah, that was a mistake. We had to actually fudge that because I couldn't get around that edit. So we had to do da da da. It's like, man. But I still think that there's something in having the kind of presence of mind to be resourceful, right? To like turn a mistake into an opportunity, I guess, as you'd put it.
Well, yeah, and being able to recognize that, yeah, this is pretty neat. Let's keep it, mm-hmm. You know, because I'm sure the temptation would be to make it more like something else you've heard before, you know? And being able to do something completely different is a talent, and the talent to recognize that it's useful is also important.
I think perfection being the enemy of good is something that is a mantra that I take with me to kind of every record that I work on. Because again, I also am like, in some ways, I sort of have bouts of imposter syndrome because I'm just like, I didn't go to school for this. How is this even a real job? Like, I just kind of gave my opinion for 7 hours and then they liked it. You know, like it's still kind of nebulous to me that this is even something I could get paid for, let alone make a living at. But in that gratitude, I feel like to pay back into it, I should at least be adventurous, and perfect is kind of not what I want to strive for. You know, interesting is what I want to strive for, and I think that's what a lot of artists want to do too. I'm curious what, if you have any examples in mind where you were like, how did he keep that, or what, and or if I remember what the hell I did. I'm curious if you had any at the top of mind.
I'd have to go back and listen because so many of the things just go by so fast, and I'd say, that was cool, you know. I wasn't expecting that.
Chances are I wasn't either.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I've said I've been recording stuff for 50 years, you know. And what I always say to people is, play me something I haven't heard before, please. I just want to find something that doesn't sound like everything else. I'm glad you're able to do that and be so successful with it. I think that's great.
Yeah, I think I've been lucky that, as you said earlier on, like I've had great mentors early on in my career, but I think also a lot of the people that I have around me are younger, and they have this sort of beginner's mind, and they help me kind of keep my beginner's mind to things. You know, my assistant Brandon is great, and oftentimes, not only does he give me mixed notes or ideas on things, but he and I have a language that similarly I had with Tony and with John Castelli and Spider, that, you know, when we all work together, just talking in terms of emotions instead of technical things.
Right.
We all know that we know how to find the technical correlation to an emotion, but let's just speak in terms of emotions, you know, like just say you're not feeling like the second chorus lyric is quite sad. The production is not supporting that. Okay. We all know how to do what we need to do to make that fit that emotion, you know, but I think keeping, and that's one thing I learned early on, is if you want to, everyone wants their music to be heard by as many people as possible. I don't know if you can do that without having a lot of people involved in the making of the music, or at least, and involved in the looser sense of the term, meaning just input, or having them, having kind of a community of people around you that are helping it make it better. And that's something that I really value too. Just like, I think that one of the greatest contributions that studios can have in the modern era is to function as community spaces, is to function as a place where people can both feel really safe and really pushed to do their best. And I think that helps the music to have young people around and sort of the more experienced people converge, you know, because then the dialogue that happens there is we're not worried about perfection. We're worried about, just as you're saying, something that hasn't happened before. Something that you haven't heard before, something that's new and interesting.
Yeah, that reminds me of my first studio, which I opened in 1969. And it was 4-track on a 1/2-inch Ampex machine. And I quickly had a bunch of people that were usually within walking distance of the studio who were good musicians. Maybe not great, but good. But they had enthusiasm. And when it came time to do a project, and one songwriter would say, we need somebody to play a really nice electric guitar part on that, you could just call them up and say, hey, we're working on this, you want to come put a part on it? And they'd be there in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And do it and do innovative stuff. And we were playing around with all kinds of weird stuff. I mean, some of the things that I did back then was so different from the kind of recording I do now, in the sense that we had to deal with so many limitations, with lack of tracks, lack of equipment, you know, and those limitations made us be more creative, I thought.
Limitations as a creative device are one of my favorite things. Sometimes you have to, these days, you kind of have to artificially make them sometimes, because you have unlimited tracks and you have unlimited hard drive space.
Right. Yeah, I've actually talked to some of the people I'm working with that I've worked with since back in those days, and said, let's do a project where we just have 4 tracks and 6 microphones to choose from. And let's just see what we get.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah. So I mean,
the average laptop these days comes with more recording horsepower than they had when they made, you know, when Bruce Springsteen made Nebraska, you know, like,
right.
And I think, I mean, that's some of the reasons why I enjoy recording to tape, although I will say it with the caveat that I think it's overly romanticized. Mm-hmm. And I definitely, go into a speed round of questions when an artist says they want to record onto tape, and I suss out whether or not they're romanticizing it or whether they're ready. But I'd say the first 5 reasons why I like to record on tape don't really have to do with sonics. I enjoy the workflow, if it's the right artist, and I enjoy the cadence of it, and I enjoy the requisite inventiveness. You kind of, like, I feel like I'm the best engineer I can be when I'm recording on tape, and my punch finger can ruin an entire take. Or if I don't keep good notes, I brought up the wrong reel, and we weren't doing overdubs on the master take. We were doing overdubs on the, or comping on tape, comping vocals on tape. I mean, my God. But I like the workflow. And I think that half the reason that people say things come together on tape or mixes come together on tape quicker don't have to do with Sonics. I think it's because you've made decisions each and every step of the way that are serving the song, that are, that the jigsaw puzzle is kind of naturally has to come together because you've only got 23 tracks if you're going to have Simpty or Click or whatever, right? So I enjoy those limitations because it makes you be more inventive. Now, do I want to record every project on tape? No, and most people can't afford it anyway because a reel of tape ain't cheap. But I like kind of bringing that headspace or that frame of mind into other things, into other limitations.
Well, yeah, there's definitely a different workflow with tape, and it's sort of a little bit more deliberative in the sense that, you know, it takes a finite amount of time to back up the tape if you're going to punch something in. Mm-hmm. And you don't have the tracks there to do 10 different vocal takes and then comp it together out of the pieces. And to a certain extent, I still work the way I worked with tape, especially when it comes to like cutting vocals, because mm-hmm. I will end up always with just one vocal track. Well, occasionally two, but usually just one vocal track. And I just work my way through it with the artist. And we punch it in and we just keep moving along until we get a final thing. We make the decisions as we're going along, which is part of the discipline of tape, because you don't have the luxury of doing a lot of stuff later. You have to do a lot of your EQing ahead of time while you're tracking, because you're not going to be able to boost 10K on the drums or the vocal track after the fact, because it'll be too much tape noise, too much hiss.
Yep.
And especially with a limited track count, you need to plan ahead because you're going to have to bounce some of those tracks down. And once you've done that, you're committed to that. You can't change that balance later.
You're committed to your noise floor too.
Right.
Which is cumulative. Yep.
Yep. And so some of those habits I carry into the digital world, but you know, I don't want to go back to tape. It was such a pain. It took so much time to set up the machines and, you know, as you said, it's expensive and, you know, there's no undo button on a tape machine. It's just, digital is so much easier, but I understand, I agree with you. I think the appeal to it isn't so much the sound, it's the choices you're forced to make when you use tape. And that was what made a lot of those records from back then sound like they do. It wasn't that they were consciously deciding to do it that way. They had no choice.
Mm-hmm. I think also, like, for tape, I mean, man, I have so many things to say about tape. I probably do maybe one, maybe two tape projects a year, you know, and I would expect that to kind of dwindle in the future. But I think it also comes down to the X factor of, like, I think with the right band, I think it's fun. You know, like with a band like Bad Bad Not Good, it's fun because they're not married to hunting perfection. They know when they've got it, and they also are like, yeah, cool, should we just mix this one down and then we can keep making more music? You know, it's not you're not tweaking something to death. But I do like what you're saying, the rewind time. I like the ear break there. I also like that you get to be a bit more deliberate and intentional, I guess would be the best word, about what you're going to do. Because as I'm rewinding, I know that the downbeat is at 13.057, you know. But if it's a guitar track, I really want to punch in a little bit before that because it's an upstroke I want to catch on the, you know, and the guitarist is thinking about what she's going to do. And I think sometimes in modern recording, and this is just the way that it goes, and I'm not like a Luddite by any stretch, but it's sort of, okay, let me get another track. All right, one more time. Let me do it. And it's just sort of like, what are we doing? Why are we doing another take? You know, like I think just even considering why is sometimes that intentionality can be really useful in the recording process. And like you're saying, comping as you go, or as a filmmaker would say, editing in camera, you know, mm-hmm. getting it as you go, because that sort of helps you fill the container with liquid and see where the cracks are as you go, rather than doing an elaborate comp process where you're sort of just making a hodgepodge of something and, okay, maybe it sounds good, maybe it sounds great, but the intentionality, I think, is missing sometimes. Yeah, I think before you even make a tape order, you know, back in the day, you'd had to make a commitment to what you wanted something to sound like. So are you using GP9 or 456 Quantigy or Bassif 900 or 996, which was my favorite tape back in the day? What type of tape machine are you using? What IPS are you recording? You're already, before you even aligned the tape machine, which is also making a musical and sonic decision, you're already committing. And that committing usually means you have a vision. And I think that that's what I like about tape. And I try to keep, and that doesn't mean that you can't, I'm not saying you can't have that on digital. You can, and that's sort of the same kind of philosophical underpinnings that I would have on tape, because I started out in a time engineering where like tape was sort of done on maybe half of sessions, or maybe a little bit less than half, but it was Pro Tools, but Pro Tools was kind of the Wild West. You had to sort of have this sense of, okay, there's a vision here. We're gonna have that, you know, or I want that nice head bump, so we're gonna go at 15, or I want that saturation, so we're gonna use a lower output. We're gonna use 456 tape or whatever. So I like the committing early on. I like that there's a vision rather than let's just get it all down, throw it against the wall, and then we'll make a thing later. You know, that's less exciting for me. I guess maybe it's just the tape paradigm that I enjoy. And I like, you know, I like the problem solving, and I like the, if an artist is going to say, let me get another take, they have to know that they're going to beat it, because once I hit punch, that's gone, you know? So I enjoyed that too. I mean, I think, you know, if I do get a live room, again, I do a proper build out in a studio, which I might be doing in the next year or so, I probably would have a tape machine. Would it be a 24 track? I don't know. It depends if I can get one for a good deal, but I think a 16 track would be nice, or an 8 track would be nice, but I would probably use it more as a kind of effects unit or saturation box, or a passion project of like what you were saying. Let's just get one down on 8 track and we'll mix one. We'll mix to the half inch and call it a day.
And especially with lower track counts on a tape machine, basically when you finish all your tracking, the mix is done.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, I mean, if you're doing your job right, yeah.
Faders, I think that's Unity, true with digital pretty, too, but I mean, yeah. We've gotten into this habit of just saying, oh, well, we'll make something out of this somehow.
Yeah. And you can. It's not like you can't, but it's also, I think it's tougher with that mentality to make something that's better than just competent. You know, I think if you want to go for something like what you were saying earlier, that you haven't heard before, that hits that aspirational point of great and unique, I think you've got to have a vision. You know, I don't think, I never met the man, so I don't know, but I don't think that Picasso was like painting something and like not really knowing what he wanted it to look like. I like to think that he kind of had the canvas already mapped out in his brain and he was just executing. Mm-hmm. And I think that to have that vision usually serves the art really well, and even all the better if everybody involved in the process has the same vision. Well, now we're really getting somewhere. Now we're going to create something special.
I've been talking with producer, engineer, mixer Chris Tabron. Our conversation was about 2.5 hours long, of which this is the first hour. The second portion was less formal, really just the two of us chatting about things. He offers some great insights into his philosophy of making records and working with artists. Chris had some questions for me, too. I'll post that part of our conversation in a future episode. Chris recorded in his studio in Brooklyn using a Shure SM7 mic into a Neve 1073 module. I was using my usual AEA 44 mic into a VT2 mic preamp. This is My Take on Music Recording. I'm Doug Fearn. See you next time.